Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, and Micah Sargent. We talk about the SolarWinds hack. Is it the biggest hack in U.S. history? Certainly feels that way, but maybe too early to tell. Also, Apple Fitness Plus is here, and it's going to get you fit in quarantine, believe it or not. Why is cash still king in Japan? And there are plenty of people taking advantage of these rewards to peel people away from using cash. And finally, Google's facing antitrust charges of its own. We got a whole lot to talk about this week on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. We know you're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure that they are by making access and authentication seamless, whether employees are working in the office or remotely. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 163, recorded Thursday, December 17th, 2020.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by RemoteWorks, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories of teams that made the shift to working remotely. Search for RemoteWorks anywhere you listen to podcasts and download each episode today.
And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/TNW.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week of the year, save for a couple, we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other, Jason Howell. Good to see you, Micah. And my goodness, this is one of those weeks where, like, the news, there's an obvious top story and we had to talk about it today.
Yes, like, no question. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, indeed. So at an incredibly vulnerable moment in the U.S., there was a discovery just a few days ago, December 13th, that many U.S. government agencies were infiltrated by some very stealthy hacking going on behind the scenes. And now those agencies and companies around the world are scrambling to figure out exactly who did it, just what exactly the hackers have accessed, what the long-term ramifications are. So many open-ended questions. We're at the beginning of a very large story here. And joining us to talk about arguably one of the biggest hacks in U.S. history is author and security and privacy specialist Bruce Schneier. Welcome back to the show, Bruce.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And yes, it's a weird
absolutely
story.
Yeah, it's huge. So I guess my first question is, would you consider this one of the biggest hacks in U.S. history? Is that overstating it?
I don't know. It might be overstating it. Years we can tell nothing classified was accessed, so that's important as opposed to some other Russian attacks that got into classified networks. It's pretty massive. It's a supply chain hack, which makes it interesting. It seems like this could have affected thousands of companies, although we're unsure how many it actually affected. It's big. We don't really know the contours of it yet to put it in ranking of others.
Sure. It's big. Not only is it big, but it's fresh. Like, really, we've had 4 days to kind of digest anything about this. A lot of people are being very quiet about this, which tells you there's a lot happening behind the scenes to try and figure things out. Let's maybe start with the breach itself. How was it detected? I know FireEye detected this breach. Were they going in because they suspected something? Did they run across it by accident? What was going on to lead to the detection of this?
I don't know. My guess is they ran across it by accident. I don't know the details of how FireEye figured it out. But, you know, there's also the initial infection vector, which is the SolarWinds, and we'll talk about that. And then there's sort of what happened after. And I don't know if FireEye found something after and worked backwards, or they noticed the malware in the update, or what they did.
Yeah, very interesting. So what we hear with this story, and I mean, you mentioned it right off the top, you know, the word Russia gets thrown around a lot and has for the past 4 years for good reason. Does FireEye or does anyone else really have a very solid understanding of who the bad actor is in this case? Or is it really, again, like many other aspects of this story, potentially just kind of conjecture, like we have a strong suspicion, but nothing for certain to point to.
You know, my guess is it's more than a strong suspicion. We wouldn't, FireEye wouldn't be saying, Russia wouldn't be saying SVR in particular if they didn't know. Attribution is actually not as hard as some people think. It can be relatively easy to figure out who an attacker is, especially if you can see a lot of the attack. So if FireEye is making that attribution, my guess is that's real, and that's not something that'll change as we learn more.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned SolarWinds, and in particular, supply chain attack. So before we kind of dive into that and unpack that, what exactly is a supply chain attack as far as what we're seeing here?
So that's just attacking via something in the supply chain. So an example would be a fake app in the Google Play Store is a supply chain attack. Another one is a NotPetya, which was distributed through a fake update to a Ukrainian accounting package. Another supply chain attack might be a malicious coder working at, I'll make this up, Microsoft, adding a backdoor into Windows because he's paid by some third party. Those are all examples of attacks happening before the product kind of gets to the customer. It's all about that supply chain. Another one is an example that Snowden unveiled, which is NSA adding backdoors into Cisco routers as they're being shipped to the Syrian telephone company.
That's right.
The shipping part of the supply chain. So in this case, this is the update. The SVR hacked into SolarWinds and was able to add malware into an update for the Orion package. That update gets downloaded, and we all know, as when we get an update, we update our software. So we're all now updating it with this piece of malware. And that's how the breach happened.
Which is kind of
pretty darn clever, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that's the perfect way to do it, because everybody's ingrained knowledge, at least especially at the level of the organizations that this is affecting, is when an update comes out, this is the way to protect yourself, is to update so that you get those protections, not update so that you're completely unprotected based on something you didn't know was there.
And SolarWinds is used by a lot of people. So they took down the webpage a couple of days ago, but when I looked at it, I think on over the weekend, there's a webpage about their customers, over 300,000 customers worldwide, including more than 400 of the Fortune 500, more than 10 of the U.S. telcos, all branches of the military, Pentagon, State Department, NSA. They used to be proud of that before a couple of days ago. And that page is down. I have a quote on my website, which I grabbed from it. Right? So you hack the supply chain, you could potentially get everybody. Now, we're pretty sure that the SVR didn't actually attack all 300,000 customers. They would be working much more slowly and carefully. And now it's to figure out, you know, who was hacked and how badly. And even worse, what happened? If you hack into a system using this SolarWinds update, you start moving laterally, you establish persistence. I mean, CISA said, I think yesterday, that everyone should delete SolarWinds from their networks. That'll just deal with any potential new breaches. The only way to make sure that you're secure is to take your network, burn it down to the ground, and rebuild it from scratch. God, no one wants to do that.
Yeah, and I think that's really, you know, part one of the big questions that I think everybody has, and certainly a question I had coming into this interview, is how possible it is to have any sort of certainty. Like, you know that they've had access for 6 to 9 months, but how do you know what that access leads to? What, you know, whether they still have active control over systems? I mean, I guess that's just part of the work going on behind the scenes right now to discover.
Right, you don't know. You're going to go in. You're going to look for other access points. You look for other malware that might have been left behind. But truly, if you care about your security, you are going to burn your network to the ground. You're going to boot it up from scratch, from known good references, to make sure that there isn't some malware, you know, hiding somewhere that the attackers dropped after they accessed via this SolarWinds backdoor. You have no other option. That's what you do.
Okay. I
know,
hear
it's
you
not
saying
be
that.
Christmas for a lot of people.
I mean, I hear you saying that. It makes perfect sense. But then I think of like hundreds of government agencies and organizations all doing that. Like, I just don't see that happening.
Companies worldwide. That's what SolarWinds website said. So yes, there's a lot of people, and a lot of people aren't going to do that. I mean, let's be honest. And maybe they'll be okay, right? Maybe their network wasn't accessed through this backdoor, and maybe they're not going to be okay. But I would hope that all the top telcos, all branches of the military, you know, all five of the top five U.S. accounting firms, I'm reading from their customer list, all of these networks do that because it does matter.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it does. So, okay, 6 to 9 months of access at this point that we know of. What is the most, if you had to like summarize the most direct concern that people have as far as like what, you know, what kind of control, direct access, let's say the Russian government, you know, that's on the other side of this, if that is true, like what are those strings that they can pull if people are really kind of looking at this critically and thinking, oh, shoot, this is what it could possibly lead to?
So we don't know. We don't know the details of the networks that were accessed. We were told no classified networks. No, we don't know if that's true, but we don't know the details of the data. I mean, this is an intelligence goldmine, and it could be an enormous amount of very sensitive yet unclassified U.S. data and worldwide. So we really don't know at all, at least us right now in the unclassified world, what was taken and what it might mean. We might never know. I mean, that information might itself be classified. Presumably, the U.S. government is going through an enormous amount of forensics to figure out what was accessible and, if they can, what was accessed. But we have no idea at this point.
Oh, see, I want an end to this story, but, you know, we possibly will never get it.
I know, it's only the first few days. We all want the answer quick, but it's going to take a while.
I'm just a little impatient. It's my holiday impatience going on right now. Bruce, thank you so much for taking some time to hop on with Mike and I to talk about this. Bruce Schneier, of course, can be found at his site, schneier.com. If people want to follow you online, like on social media, where can they do so?
You know, just go to schneier.com and you'll see the various ways to find me. But mostly I'm on that website.
Awesome. Bruce, take care of yourself. Have a great holiday. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, in its continued push for services, Apple launches a fitness streaming service. More on that shortly, but first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by RemoteWorks. I give you a little preview of that at the beginning of the show. RemoteWorks is a podcast that tells extraordinary tales of teams that made the shift to working remotely. And in fact, I was able to get a sneak peek of season 2 of RemoteWorks, and they kicked things off with a really fascinating story called Racing into a New World of Work, where the host Melanie Green speaks with Aston Martin Red Bull racing drivers and talks to them about what the pandemic taught them about adapting to working differently. Christian Horner, Aston Martin Red Bull racing team principal, shared insights into how he kept his team close when half of them were suddenly forced to work remotely. You can probably imagine that having the right technology was the key. And you should also check out, if that one sounds interesting to you, the second episode of season 2. It's called Extreme Arctic Edition. Picture living in a tiny hut built in the 1930s. You don't get running water. You don't get electricity. And the nearest town is 86 miles away. By the way, you know who comes a-knocking as your nearest neighbors looking for a cup of sugar? It's polar bears. You can check this out and hear about their home office in the heart of Svalbard, Norway. And in fact, I think our technical director has a clip for you to play.
We are officially called Rocket Citizen Scientists from NASA. We have been taking time-lapse aurora photography for something called Aurorasaurus. It's profoundly interesting for us to be involved in these projects because we sort of like flip the lid off our curiosity. We are continually learning.
anything called Aurorasaurus is something that I am interested in, and I imagine you would be too. You're going to even learn about digital nomads that work from the beach in Barbados, Bali, and beyond, the three Bs. It's not just stories about remote work, though. Each episode is full of insight. You get advice about how you can do this for your team. So if you're leading a team and are still looking for ways to work remotely properly or haven't quite figured out that one task that you definitely want to do remotely, this is a great way to get some inspiration. Distributed work, of course, brings challenges, but it also represents opportunity. And that's what Remote Works is all about, helping you find new ways to work, collaborate, and discover new possibilities. Search for Remote Works anywhere you listen to podcasts and download each episode today. That's Remote Works. Download it today. And of course, thank you to Remote Works for sponsoring this episode of Tech News Weekly. Alrighty, folks, this is some very exciting news. If you're wanting to get up and get rolling, get going, get moving, Apple Fitness Plus has launched. This is the latest in Apple's services, and it is a streaming fitness network for a subscription fee that you pay each month. I am excited to say that we are joined by someone, a prolific writer of Apple Fitness Plus at this point, Michael Potuck from 9 to 5 Mac, who joins us today. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Excellent. So, yeah, I mean, I tend to use 9 to 5 Mac as one of my top sources for Apple news. And so it's always great whenever we can get somebody on the show from there. But in going through, it became very clear at least 4 stories you've written about Apple Fitness Plus. And I think that we should start with what Apple Fitness Plus is. So let's pretend there's somebody who has not heard of this yet. What does Apple Fitness Plus provide, and what is it?
Yeah, I think Peloton, is making inroads, and there's more people aware of it, but it's still a little bit more of a niche offering as far as a workout service. But I think Apple is really going to break into the mainstream here with Fitness Plus. And Apple kind of pitches it as a great fitness workout service for anyone. And just in the little bit I've used it, I think they really have achieved that. It's super easy to get started. I think it's not intimidating, but for people who are fitness fanatics, they're going to find something too. I think it's a really approachable fitness service that you can just use anywhere.
So one of the things that I noticed in getting started was that there's a little bit of a difference in the way that you get started, and a little bit of confusion in the way that you get things going. Because on an iPhone, it's one way in one app. On an iPad, you have to download an app. And on the Apple TV, it's another way. So can you actually sort of go down the line, say somebody wants to start it on the Apple TV, where do they go? Somebody wants to start it on the iPhone, where do they go? Somebody wants to start it on their iPad, where do they go?
Yeah, that's a great point. Once you're started, it's pretty seamless. There have been some early bugs. But on iPhone, once you download iOS 14.3, then the Fitness Plus tab is going to be included right within the new fitness app. That was previously called the Activity app. So if anyone's kind of confused where that went, that's what happened there. So you've got you can kind of even see on the image there, the Fitness Plus tab is right in the middle bottom of the new iPhone app. And that kind of gives you a welcome and kind of gets you started. That may be the easiest place to start, as long as somebody has an iPhone, and they probably do if you've got an Apple TV or an iPad. Like you said, on iPad, it doesn't show up automatically with iPad OS 14.3, so you'll need to head to the App Store and download that manually. And then you've got pretty much the same experience as on iPhone, although you're not getting quite all the same information and tabs that you have on the iPhone app. That kind of remains the most rich place for all your fitness and workout data. Then on Apple TV, it's kind of funny, a little bit different than both iPhone and iPad. You've got tvOS 14.3 update. Once you get that, then the fitness app, in my experience, shows up automatically. Mm-hmm. It should show up on the home screen of tvOS for Apple TV users.
Yeah, that was my experience as well. It was easy to get it from the Apple TV. In fact, it was kind of front and center, middle of the device. The hardest thing, of course, when this first launched, iPad users had trouble downloading the app, and eventually, whatever it was behind the scenes that had happened, whether it was propagation or some other thing that had went wrong, it finally was available and people were able to download. And I think that speaks to one of the on its own, the troubles. Let's cast those aside because we got those ironed out. But let's talk about the fact that it is available on so many different devices. Do you see this as a positive? And more so than that, do you feel like you can get the same out of a workout can you get the same out of Apple Fitness Plus, whether you're watching it on an iPhone or you're watching it on an iPad or the big screen? Or do you kind of have a preference? You should watch it on Apple TV, but you can also, if you need to, do it iPad, iPhone.
Yeah. Great question, Micah. I think it's compelling, honestly, on any of the devices. I think people are going to love using it on Apple TV. Like my family, we've been using before Fitness Plus came out, we've been using the Peloton app on Apple TV, and I think it's a really great experience. So I think it's important that Apple launched that right at the beginning here. But I've also done a few of the workouts on iPad and iPhone, and I don't know. I think part of it might be just the mindset you're in. If you're ready to get a great workout in, I think Fitness Plus is going to be a great resource. If you're not feeling motivated or feeling like it's a struggle, maybe all of them are going to feel, not great.
Right. Yeah. Wouldn't really matter which one it is. That's true. Okay. That makes sense. And then let's talk about a couple of confusions. First, we should talk about AirPlay. For people out there who are listening who don't know, AirPlay is Apple's technology they kind of use it to define two different things. It's both an audio streaming framework and a video streaming framework or feature, meaning that you can use it to stream audio to compatible devices like speakers that have AirPlay technology. And you can also use it, if you were watching a video on your iPhone, you could then stream it to the Apple TV or similar and be able to watch that video on that device. But Fitness Plus does not offer AirPlay streaming. Do you have any, if you had to guess as an Apple watcher, why this is the case and why AirPlay is not available, what's your thought on that?
So a couple thoughts. The positive intent thought might be they wanted to keep things as simple as possible and as smooth as possible. Maybe they didn't want to throw another possible wrench in the mix here. That could be a bug. Then on the flip side, we've already got, Apple AirPlay compatibility in a lot of third-party TVs like Samsung and LG and others. It's kind of like, well, it'd be really nice if you could just use those TVs if you didn't have an Apple TV box hooked up. So the one side, maybe they'll roll it out later. On the other side, maybe they're trying to encourage more sales of Apple TV. I don't know.
Yeah, I do wonder that. And I think that one of the things that folks, the average person is not going to be aware of this, I think, but there are some methods using AirPlay streaming to rip video. And so you can sort of set up, we're getting into the deep and dark of it now, but you can set up devices that appear to be AirPlay devices that then you can record that content. And given the fact that you can't take screenshots of the Apple TV or Apple Fitness Plus content either, mm-hmm. I have a belief that plays a role in it. Now, the last thing,
that's a good point. The
other confusing thing is, for some people, in the beginning, it seemed as if an Apple Watch was a requirement in order to use Apple Fitness Plus. And the early news reports on this claimed that, and a panelist on MacBreak Weekly here on the Twit Network, Renee Ritchie, mentioned that, in fact, that was kind of what everyone was told, was that an Apple Watch was required. But it's my understanding now that that has changed. So can you talk about where you have to have an Apple Watch and where you don't have to have an Apple Watch in order to use this technology? And what does the Apple Watch provide to the experience?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So everyone was kind of scrambling, trying to figure out what's the deal here when it launched. And so Apple does still promote in a lot of their marketing images that, you know, you do have to have Apple Watch Series 3 or later. And that looks like it's the case for setting up the service, you know, kind of getting it going. But like you pointed out, you can use it on iPhone and iPad without a watch, which I think is a great move. I mean, honestly, I think, you know, there'd be a lot, probably most people would say, hey, if this is, you know, for the good of the health of the world, make it available to anyone, not just, mm-hmm. you know, Apple Watch users. But that's, you know, I guess a different conversation. But it looks like for now, and this could change with software updates, you know, Apple could change its mind or what have you. But on Apple TV, it looks like you do have to have the watch, which I think could be frustrating for some families that are trying to use Fitness Plus and share it with the Apple One Premier bundle. Mm-hmm. But it is nice. Yeah, you do have the flexibility, at least with iPhone and iPad. If you don't have the watch, if it's not charged, if you, you know, just happen to be somewhere and you want to get a quick workout in and don't happen to have it, you're fine to do that. Your other kind of follow up on that. It is pretty neat, I will say, to have that Apple Watch data kind of showing up right on screen as you're working out, having that live feedback. Apple doesn't put as much focus on competition as like Peloton does, mm-hmm. But you do have that burn bar, which is kind of neat. That shows up like right alongside your Apple Watch data in the top left corner when you're working out. I think it's an interesting start. Again, like it kind of goes back to that question, is Apple just hoping to sell more Apple Watches and broaden its lead in wearables? Or maybe it wanted to start with this experience because it thought it was best requiring Apple Watch at least to initiate the service. I don't know. I'd be hopeful at least that it would open up to everyone in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. That's my hope as well, because I think that overall this does feel like democratization of a type of fitness program that is typically kind of locked behind two walls. First, you pay for the gym membership, and then you go on to pay for a separate subscription or you know, monthly fee to take classes at that gym. This sort of takes out those two and just drops it to one subscription to be able to use this. And of course, they'll be updating and adding new content all the time. So yeah, that democratization, I think, is a really positive thing. Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. If folks want to follow you online so they can stay up to date with all the great work you're putting out there, where do they go to do that?
I am at Michael Potuck on Twitter. And that's pretty much all the social I do, really. And then just 9to5mac.com. Covering everything that's going on with Apple, including all the fitness and health.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you. And we'll have to have you back on again in the future. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Micah. Take care.
All right. Thank you so much. So up next, the power of cash. And I've gotten to the point to where I just don't even like spending cash, but cash still is king in Japan. And what fintech companies are doing to counter that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Barracuda. Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protects email, protects networks, data, and applications. Suddenly, you know, we're in this position where we have hundreds, thousands, or maybe just, you know, smaller, a handful, dozens employees all working remotely. Just point being, everybody's working at home right now, and each one of them is getting so many emails, and 91% of all cyber attacks starts in an email. So then suddenly that makes all of them vulnerable. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversation hijacking. It's just really easy for one wrong email to cost you money, customers, your reputation, scaled across all those employees. Well, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks, of course, since January. And they've observed a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. So you want to get the protection that's going to work for your company that you need. And you can get that with Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes all-in-one email security, backup, and archiving. You get an AI-based approach for protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromise. You get an automated incident response. And actually, it gives you all the options that you need to quickly and very efficiently address these attacks when they happen. And you get security awareness training to educate your workforce. And that's so that your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. And right now, you know, like I said, coronavirus is just getting, you know, is just a huge opportunity for people who would, you know, want to benefit off of this. There are new attacks impersonating organizations like the World Health Organization. Attackers are using domain spoofing and promising information related to the coronavirus. And that's all in an attempt to trick users into a phishing scam. And that's just one example. So you want to ensure the safety and security of your business. You can do that with Barracuda. So to uncover the threats hiding in your inbox, get a free secure email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free. That's barracuda.com/TNW, barracuda.com/TNW to check it out for yourself and to learn more. And we thank Barracuda for supporting Tech News Weekly. Barracuda is your journey secured. All right, so like I said, cash is king, or so that old saying goes. In 2020, when it comes to paying for something in person, it kind of feels, at least here in the U.S., like that old adage isn't up to date, isn't kept with the times. The U.S., I would say, we're more and more increasingly comfortable with paying with digital wallets. Definitely very comfortable with paying with things like debit cards, that sort of stuff. But in Japan, things are a little bit different. And joining us to talk about the power of cash in Japan and the incentives for those who want to, who might stray from cash, let's say, is Andrew Deck. He's the co-author of a piece on Rest of World called The Rise of Japan's Loyalty Point Influencers. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi, Jason. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to get you on. I thought this was an interesting article. I love seeing how certain people can like make it their job or their passion to figure out how they can take things like these loyalty programs and actually make a good amount of money off of them and profit. But before we kind of get to the loyalty aspects themselves, let's kind of start at the basics. Basically, Japan is so focused on cash. Why is that? Why is that so important there when we've got these kind of digital ways of paying?
For sure. So today we see, 80% of consumers in Japan are choosing to use transactions in cash, before even debit or credit cards, let alone, say, Apple Pay. And like you were saying, Japan has this notoriety now for the last decade where it's, quote, unquote, cash is king. And there's a lot of theories that have circulated in English media trying to answer that exact question. And there are a lot of partial right answers, but I'd also say there's a lot of answers that kind of lean on tropes to tell the story. Sure. So U.S. commentators, say to me a lot, Japanese consumers, they're sticking to cash because they're risk averse. And, I would turn that on its head and say, hey, there have been headline-making scandals in Japan about mobile money theft. One major payment service, in 2019 launched, within days, it had $500,000 stolen through password breaches. And What my co-reporter, Kantoro Komiya, found is people feel cash is more safe in comparison because there's such low petty crime rates. People in Tokyo are walking around with $500 or more in cash in their wallet without, thinking twice about it. Another theory that kind of makes the rounds is people write that the handling or like transfer of cash is a like ceremonial act. And, that's an explanation that I think is also leaning on stereotypes to do a lot of the work for you. And what our reporting shows in this article is that part of why cash is so ingrained is because, unlike a mobile money app in South Asia or Southeast Asia, that is trying to serve the unbanked, you know, bridge that infrastructure gap. Japan actually has a highly developed banking system. And so certain parts of major cities, you could go every few blocks and there's a convenience store with an ATM machine. And, you know, at Rest of World, you know, we're an international journalism nonprofit, and we really like take it upon ourselves to go beyond the Western bubble and really kind of tell stories in places that are overlooked in conventional technology news coverage. Japan, it might not be as overlooked as some other markets that we focus on, but as you can see with cash, there's still just a lot of misunderstandings about what's driving consumer behavior.
Really, that's why part of the reason why I'm really happy to get you on, Andrew, because I thought the work that you do at Rest of World is really important. I'm firmly implanted here, obviously, in the U.S. from a U.S. perspective. I had never considered the fact that, like, you know, somewhere like Japan wouldn't be on the digital payments train along, you know, with what we're used to here. And you point this out in the article as well, especially because some of these technologies were created there. So what's up with the what can be said about kind of the disconnect there? The fact that this technology, like QR code, for example, as one example, could be created there, but yet the culture there is not as much behind that technology.
That's a great question. Yeah. So a Japanese engineer actually invented QR codes. And, you know, what we've seen in the last decade is that technology has been adopted by the fintech industry, especially in China. You know, we saw with WeChat Pay and Alipay, QR codes really kind of revolutionizing the fintech industry there, you know, since the early 2010s. That same trajectory, you know, did not happen in Japan. And a lot of that has to do with those same norms that I was talking about earlier. But you saw, you know, an app like Line. It's the most popular messaging app in Japan, majority of people using its platform. But they've struggled since the Line Pay launch in 2014 to get, you know, a good chunk of their users to, you know, convert over to becoming Line Pay users, even though they're using homegrown tech. And, you know, because of that struggle, you know, they've had to kind of come up with new strategies for getting adopters. And that's where we really see these incentives start to kick in, you know, making sure that consumers feel that they're gaining something by, you know, using your platform because they're so comfortable already with cash payments.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. So, okay, so then you've got the people that are gaming the platforms. Before we kind of dive into how they're doing that, because it's really interesting to kind of see what they're able to come up with, why are, like, explain the desire of these companies to create these loyalty programs to begin with. I mean, obviously, they're very costly for them to run, but they are incentives for people to use the platform. Like, what exactly are they offering, and how effective has it been?
Sure. So I was just talking about Line. You know, they started to create Line points, you know, several years ago. And basically the idea is every yen you use on Line Pay, you get a corresponding point. And over the course of 6 months, if you get enough, you start to get badges. You start to get silver, gold, platinum level badges. And with that comes certain kinds of savings or other rewards. You know, another popular app, it's backed by Yahoo Japan. It's called PayPay. In 2019, it managed to double its registered users in a few months just by offering these kind of like cash back flash deals. You know, for these, this month, you're going to get 20% back across PayPay payments. And, you know, other competitors in the space started to see that and see that people were actually coming to the platform, starting to register for the first time. And they started to mimic that model. And it's something that's kind of had a domino effect through the industry where more and more people are kind of taking on this idea of loyalty point systems, reward points, and using that as a way to overcome a lot of the barriers to mobile payments in Japan.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. I love how you point out in your piece, am I pronouncing it correctly? Poikatsu? Is that point
yes,
activities?
Poikatsu.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. So, where there are rewards, there are obviously these people that are looking to take a little advantage of the system. Or I don't know if it's necessarily advantage. They're just looking to maximize the returns. And so it creates this poikatsu, this subculture of people who are kind of, it's almost like they've made it their mission in life or their purpose to see just how much they can get out of this. Is this, when looking at the behavior of this, it's all legitimate. They're following the rules. Like how much are they able to kind of gain out of gaming this system?
Yeah. You know, one influencer we spoke to, you can see him there, Chicken, you know, when he came to Poikatsu, he was really struggling with his finances. You know, he was just trying to get some extra cash. And so he went online, he started a Twitter account, and he started following other Poikatsu enthusiasts. But once he became immersed in this online community, the hobby really turned into a lifestyle and kind of took over. And he says now that he's one of about 100 people in Japan who's able to make 10K a year from payment app points alone. So he's really one of these top tier accounts on Japanese social media. And he's also, alongside his own kind of point collecting, giving all of his tips to his followers. He has about 12,000 followers on Twitter right now. So it's definitely a spectrum. The average person consuming Chuken's content, probably not hitting 10K. But, you know, some of the influencers are more catered to, say, parents or families. There was one Instagrammer that we looked at, Seko. And her popular hack is teaching people how to get year-long passes to Hong Kong Disneyland. And if you're a parent, that has a very different kind of appeal. It's not just monetary.
Heck yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, like this kind of point activity is a really, it's a broad spectrum. But with these influencers, we're really seeing the most extreme version of it.
Wow. Okay. So then I guess the question that I have, like when I was reading through this, it really, what came to mind for me is like this coupon culture that I've seen a lot here in the US. Yeah. You know, you see a lot of this similar activity on Instagram, on YouTube, people who are so embedded into maximizing their savings with coupons that, you know, again, it becomes kind of their life mission or just how they manage their lives is built around these kind of incentives and coupons and everything. And I know for me, like that part of that sounds appealing because everybody would love to save some cash. But then I think of all the work and the time and the dedication that it takes to actually, you know, kind of save enough to make it worth the time. And it just seems out of scale. Do the people that are doing this similar thing, like they're only really in it because this is not a niche thing. This is something that a select few find enough juice out of the squeeze, as it were.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I can definitely say in this reporting process, there's a lot of work to do just trying to like get in the minds of these influencers and understand what is making them tick. And, you know, I also do think a lot about, you know, Groupon TikTok or mileage point obsesses in the US as a corollary. But, you know, what surprised me was that talking to these people, it's not just about the cash. You know, something we heard again and again is that this is like a sport to us. You know, finding the loopholes in service providers, trying to max out on these campaigns, this is my hobby. You know, I have my day job, but this is how I spend my free time. I think there's one survey that we included in the article. You know, 37% of these Poikatsu enthusiasts, they said they do it because it's fun for me. You know, we're really seeing a gamification, I guess you could say, of these incentive programs. You know, these influencers are part of that. It's not just getting the badge from Line Pay. It's about this culture online where influencers are sharing their hacks and trying to beat the system together in a way that's really pushing people to do this behavior that might seem kind of extreme from the outside.
Sure. And I would imagine actually there's probably a lot of similarity between that and like the extreme couponers here. You know, the people who are really dedicated to it, they're probably not just doing it for the cost savings. They're also doing it because they're good at it. They understand the system. And like you said, it's kind of a game. In a certain way, it's a game, but in real life, and you actually have a payoff instead of just, you know, getting a high score or something.
So. Yeah, it's definitely validating to be able to say like, oh, I'm one of the 100 people that can hit 10K points. You know, I'm sure people are showing off online, you know, among these accounts.
All right. Well, thank you so much for hopping on to talk about this, Andrew. Andrew Deck, of course, is the reporter and researcher at restofworld.org. If people want to follow you online, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter at Deka227, D-E-C-K-A. And also please read our work at restofworld.org.
Right on. Restofworld.org.
Great, thanks, Jason.
Thank you so much. That's it. Appreciate it.
All right.
All right. And we are going to get to a story of the week right about now. Micah, what you got?
Let me unmute my microphone so I can tell you. So, yes, there is a new story. It was the New York Times, as of this morning, updated this story about Google once again being hit with a lawsuit. So, you know, we've heard a lot about Facebook and its antitrust concerns. We've heard that, you know, multiple states sued Facebook. But one of the things that maybe folks had not paid as much attention to is that Facebook is not alone. Yeah, Google has been sued by 30 states that are saying the company essentially, if you've ever done a search for, say, your hot water heater breaks down, and you don't know what's going on, so you look up hot water heater makes rattling sound. And when you see the Google search results at the top, you might see this area of text with parts of it emboldened. And they tell you, you know, this might be the, what is it called? The sacrificial core that's, you know, there's something wrong with it. Or did you drain the hot water heater? Because folks, and this is a pro tip to you all, you should be draining your hot water heater once a year, to flush it.
Really?
Very, very, very important, okay. In fact. But anyway, that's an aside. You see that text at the top. And so what this suit from 30 different states alleges is that Google, and I'm going to read this verbatim, Google downplayed websites that let users search for information in specialized areas like home repair services and travel reviews. They also accused the company of using exclusive deals with phone makers like Apple to prioritize Google's search service over rivals like Firefox and DuckDuckGo. So first of all, that first part is true, that, you know, that you see those little bits of text. And so it may keep you from going to that website, which the argument there is then that, you know, you're snuffing out competitors. You as Google become the website that is giving that information. I do have a little bit of a problem with the second allegation, and I do wonder if it was a mistype on the New York Times' part, or if this really is the argument in the lawsuits, which claims that these deals that Google made prioritized Google's search service over Firefox and DuckDuckGo. And for those of you who know anything about tech, you're probably going, yeah, what's going on there? And for those of you who are going, why is that a problem? As far as I know, Firefox does not at all make a search engine. DuckDuckGo is a search engine, and Microsoft makes a search engine, Bing. And there are a few others out there like Yahoo somehow. And so those search engines are certainly have a case to make. But I don't know, Jason, have you ever heard of Firefox and Mozilla having a search engine?
I mean, I understand what you're saying. It is kind of strangely worded there because to my understanding, Firefox is not in itself a search engine, right? It's a browser. What I'm guessing this has to do is the fact that Apple has made collaborative efforts in the past to largely feature Google's search results over others, right? And Firefox, correct. I don't know that would necessarily fall into that. So that seems to be the one that's really out of place there is Firefox. I mean, I don't know if that also touches on the fact that, you know, a company like Apple doesn't really give you the chance to set a default outside of Safari. From my understanding, I'm not an iPhone user.
Maybe they
made a change
anymore.
Recently that that allows you to do that. So that has changed things. But I do know that Google has been very keen and adept at making sure that their search service appears on iOS devices. and on Android devices, which is, you know, a large part why the antitrust charges keep coming up. And, you know, you could liken that to the Microsoft antitrust suit, where ultimately Microsoft ended up having to acquiesce and offer, you know, a range of browsers when you set up a Windows install to say like, hey, look, we're not only letting people install Internet Explorer. We are giving them the option. Google's even doing this on certain Android phones in Europe. So there's something to be said for that. So it feels kind of like a combination of both of those when I read it.
Yeah. In fact, this is one of the biggest earners for Apple in its services section of its earnings every year, is the money that Google just hands over to Apple.
Right.
In order to make Google the default search engine. There was a period of time, there was an iOS version where they had undone that. But then they since changed it back. So yes, that part makes sense. That part of the lawsuit makes sense, that Apple does prioritize because of the deal where Google says, here's money. And then Apple says, thanks. And then in Safari, mm-hmm. your default search engine is Google. And of course you can change it, but there is that prioritization there. So that makes sense. But this is, you know, these antitrust concerns are all about monopolies. And the argument, again, from this New York Times article, talks about how Google has a 90% market dominance in search. And the 90%. Argument is that, which is wild, right? And because of this, the claim is that it makes it impossible for smaller companies to even try to compete. And we have, you know, regulations in the United States where other companies are meant to be given the opportunity to compete, as opposed to a company being able to take on that alone. So this is one of, you know, the New York Times also includes 10 other states accused Google of abusing its dominance in advertising just yesterday. And overcharging publishers for advertisements. And then 2 months ago, the Justice Department said that Google, having deals with other tech giants like Apple, throttled competition. So again, this is just the latest in a line of suits made against Google for antitrust concerns. And I mean, you're more of obviously a Google watcher than I am. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You know, when some of these claims are made against Apple in different areas, but certainly for the antitrust concerns, as an Apple watcher, there were things where I could go, yeah, I see what the argument is there. And somewhere mm-hmm. I was kind of like, that feels reaching maybe. So I'm curious your reaction to this and this latest claim made against Google.
I mean, I feel like it's inevitable, and it's been on the horizon for so long, you know, and seeing the Facebook, you know, antitrust case, the case coming down hard on Facebook, and we're going to be hearing about that for years. It's only a matter of time before the same scrutiny, you know, is continued to be placed on Google, at least here in the U.S. So, you know, do I think that it's worth investigating? Well, sure. I mean, I think it's undeniable to say that Google has their hooks in everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, when it comes to search, I mean, I actually just did the search because I don't have an Amazon Echo device. So I was like, wait a minute, what is the search engine powering that? And that's Bing. So there are examples of these devices, you know, these categories that are have weaned themselves or not even entered the fray with the Google dominated search. But I mean, when you're talking about 90% of the market, you know, funneling through Google, of course that's going to get some attention. Google owns, you know, the Android operating, owns and manages the Android operating system. And there's a whole bunch of, you know, things to at least look at when concerned with, you know, the fact that Google is setting rules that require their services to be embedded on certain Android devices. The alternative is, well, don't, you know, install a build of Android that has any of our services in it. And that is totally possible. It's called the AOSP, Android Open Source Project. And you could install a version of Android that doesn't have any Google hooks in it. But nobody does that because
that sounds miserable.
Exactly. Anybody who buys those phones, the majority of people are going to be expecting, you know, the things that make those phones the Android that they're used to, which is Google services. And that's, you know, that's by design, I feel like. I enjoy using Google's services, and I enjoy kind of when all of the devices that I have interoperate and interchange and everything. I can also see why that is, you know, why that has the potential to be focused on in suits like this. And I'm not surprised at all. And I'd be very curious if there aren't ramifications that come out about this eventually, especially considering where we're headed when we take a look at a company like Facebook and what they're facing. I mean, Google's like right up there with them, and it all involves data and the power and control of that data. I think Google's, you know, in the same category, and it'll be interesting.
Yep. Again, this is one of those things we have to watch, because as is the case with Facebook, you know, this is a multi-year process in the end of it, and this is bound to be a multi-year process for Google as well. So
many things that we have to wait years for.
Yeah, can't unwrap any presents yet, folks.
We're going to be waiting years for the Facebook antitrust stuff to iron itself out, for the Google antitrust stuff to iron itself out, for the SolarWinds stuff. We may never know. There's just too much waiting. But I guess that's just what we have to do. All right. We have reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. You're going to have to wait 2 weeks for the next live Tech News Weekly, because next week the studio is dark. We're out for the holidays. But have no fear. There will be an episode. It's going to be a best of 2020. Mike and I picked out a couple of interviews from throughout the year that we thought were awesome and that were worth replaying. So look for that in the feed, twit.tv/TNW. And then, of course, like I said, 2 weeks from now, every Thursday beyond that, we're going to be recording another episode of Tech News Weekly.
There you go. And of course, you should follow us on social media. We are at Twit on Twitter, at twit.tv on Instagram, at Twit Talk on TikTok. And of course, I am at Micah Sargent on pretty much all of the social media networks. So if you want to tweet at me or follow my Instagram or whatever, you can go there. As of this morning, the announcement has been made. I am very excited to say that on iOS today, I will be taking over the lead host role, and the incredible, inimitable, and absolutely nerdy and awesome and clever and hilarious and amazing and radiant and super cool Rosemary Orchard will be joining me as my co-host on iOS today in the new year. This is something awesome that I am so much looking forward to. Rosemary's been a guest on the show several times, and every time she's on, always so great. And whenever, you know, Leah was looking to cut back on a few shows, because by God, he's still doing 7 shows a week, which just sounds exhausting to me. The fun that we've had on iOS today, I have enjoyed, and I will miss him on that show, but truly no better person to join me as a co-host than Rosemary Orchard. It's going to be incredible. So to infinity and beyond there on iOS today.
Yeah. Congratulations. That's awesome. Looking forward to seeing her on a weekly basis, because she's been awesome when she's been on. So that is good news. Anyone who wants to know, by the way, all of this news, you can find it on the Twit side. Just look for a post that went up today. Lisa Laporte put it up. So look for a post titled Changes at Twit for 2021, which basically spells out the change at iOS today. Some of our hands-on shows are going away. So normally at this point of the show, we'd be throwing you a referral to jump over to Hands on iOS and Hands on Android. Those shows are no more, but all of that content is going to be folded into Hands on Tech. So twit.tv/HOT going forward. Anything that you might see on one of those other hands-on shows, you're going to see on a weekly basis in Hands-On Tech. So they aren't going away for good, just kind of redirected. But there you go. You can find me at Jason Howell on Twitter. And big thanks to everyone who helps us do this show every week. Of course, John Ashley, Burke in the studio as well. And thanks to you for watching each and every week. We'll see you next time on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye, folks.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and we talk about everything that has to do with Android. Is it news? Is it hardware? Is it apps? Well, you name it, we talk about it. We invite guests from the industry on the show. We even sometimes have people from the Android team themselves talking about what makes Android so great. And you can subscribe so you don't miss anything about the world of Android by going to twit.tv/AAA. We'll see you there.